Azure drones, microchips and stuffs, iPhone cameras plus, taco salad plus, Boba Rama goes us, Olive Garden us, White Foster us, Zabra Hamas, Hezbollah sus.
Hello, and welcome to Bad Hasbara, the most moral podcast in the world. Of all the podcasts that exist in the world, we have the most morality. That's right. And it is I, your most moral host, Matt Lieb. Thank you so much for joining us for another episode of Bad Hasbara. What is Hasbara, you ask yourself, if this is your first time listening? It is loosely the Hebrew word for explaining. It explains, and it is also mostly just means the Israeli attempt to spin all the news narratives in their favor. It is propaganda, and we got a lot of propaganda to talk about, but first, I'm going to do some propaganda for my own benefit. First things first, about 8.5 inches. Just kidding, sorry. Come to the Sacramento Punchline. I'm going to be there with my wife, Francesca Fiorentini, Sunday, March 17th at 7 p.m. There's a link in the description. Click it and then come. Please buy tickets. Tell your friends who are in the Sacramento area to come. Secondly, patreon.com/badhasbara. Support this podcast. It is demonetized for now. Maybe it'll stop being demonetized once we stop doing copyright infringement. But until then, please. I mean, even after then, please support the Patreon, patreon.com/badhasbara. And finally, last things last, shout out to our brand new, or not brand new, but now paid producer, Adam Levin, who is here. This is becoming more and more of a, what do you call it? Professional podcast. And we have a producer, and I want to thank Adam. Adam's going to be here just making sure everything goes smoothly and stuff like that. And again, that's why we need you to join the Patreon, patreon.com/badhasbara. Also, please listen to the podcast. Don't watch me. I can't make money. Sorry for yelling, but YouTube is an impossible game. Okay. First things first, I'm going to bring in the second most moral host of this podcast. Ladies and gentlemen, Daniel Mate is back. What's up, buddy?
Oh, hi. Sorry. I was just thinking about those 8.5 inches.
I mean, listen, but that's fully, bricked up. Not when it's small, not when it's tired.
Whatever it takes. Best of times. True. It was the best of times. It was the it was the shortest worst times.
Yeah. Something like that. How are you doing, buddy?
Oh, we're off to a cracking start here. I'm all right, thank you. It's a cold, blustery, sunny March day early in the spring forward time frame here in New York City. It's one of those days that wants to be spring, but can't quite get winter out of its system. So
physically not able to, but it looks good. You just can't go outside or else you'll freeze to death.
Yeah. You can't go outside expecting a nice day with blossoms and birds. It still feels pretty breezy. How are you?
I'm pretty good. It's LA. So the weather's pretty much always the same, which is nice. Cause it makes you forget all problems, and it makes you go, oh, sun's out. Nothing can be bad when sun is out. So, I have that going.
That's great. I mean, that's why LA is considered the happiest place on earth, right? There's
that's right.
Rates of depression and self-hatred are just, there's just no one there who's hating life, and
no one has ever moved drank to themselves Los Angeles to death and thought to themselves, life is meaningless. I should die. No, everyone comes here to live. Except if you're born and raised here, like I was, then you're just born and raised with the human condition of being I want to die. I hate the sun. And
there's no LA for you to, and there's no LA for you to move to.
There's no LA for me to move to unless I move to Israel, land of the free.
Exactly.
Home of the brave. Yes. Today I want to introduce our guest because we have a great guest today with us for just the first hour, as if there's a second hour. With us for most of the podcast, a fantastic guest. This is a media critic, an AJ Plus presenter, and former coworker of mine back when I used to work at AJ Plus. Ladies and gentlemen, and everyone else, welcome Sana Sayed. Sayed, sorry. Fuck.
It's okay. It's okay. It's at least you didn't say Sayed the way everyone's like, oh, Edward Sayed, Sana Sayed. I'm like, no.
Matt was so Matt. You wrote it. You said it wrong.
I said it.
You
wrong.
Said it. You said it all wrong.
Where were you when? Where was that fucking pun when I needed it at the beginning to get it in my brain?
It's okay. You'll get it next time.
Yeah.
If you don't, that'll just be the bit.
Yeah, that'll be the bit. So far, you know, that is a running gag of mine accidentally, is me not being able to pronounce my guests' names.
Tig's video about that was hysterical. You're Irish, Irish guy? I'm going to meet him in a few weeks. I'm going to Ireland. He's going to come to my talk. But I was talking to him today, and he made that hilarious video about watching Bad Hasbara, and his, you know, he's looking all happy that you're mentioning him, and then you and Fran do the American comedian thing of just butchering his name on purpose, and he looks so crestfallen.
We butchered his name. It's spelled Tadgah. Okay?
It is spelled Tadgah. Yeah.
It's not my fault that in Ireland they pronounce your names wrong or spell them wrong. Well, it's one of the two. All right. Sorry, but Sana. Thank you so much for coming on. I've known you for a long time. We worked at AJ Plus together. You're still there, is that right?
Yes, I am.
Nice.
Almost 10 years strong. Also, wanted to thank you so much for forcing me to think about 8.5 inches on the first day of Ramadan. Fantastic.
Awesome. It's how I like to start the podcast out. I like to let people know up top that this is it's not exactly going to be if you're here looking for journalism, I can't do that for you, but I can make a dick joke up top. That's what I'm
Look,
about.
Look, man, it's not called Goody Goody Hasbara. It's Bad Hasbara. We're bad here.
We're bad.
We misbehave a little, you know. We like to get a little saucy, a little spicy.
Yeah, we're a spice podcast, just spicy Jews. So you have been doing some, what I would consider some of the most standout work that I've seen in the last few months regarding all of this, especially and specifically regarding the media critique. I have been my go-to account on Twitter for finding headlines that completely misrepresent the actual story of what's going on currently in Gaza, or what's going on, anywhere, you know, in the West Bank and in 48 as well. And just, it's been interesting to watch, because I think I've seen more of a concerted effort on the media's part to obscure and obfuscate the facts of what's happening for any given story. And I wanted to know, do you look through it yourself? Do you wake up in the morning, grab a cup of coffee, and just start perusing the New York Times?
Bold of you to assume that I wake up and grab a cup of coffee, as opposed to roll over, grab my phone, and go, let's go.
Yeah.
So usually it's a mix of things. I will wake up and I'll go through the headlines of all the major news organizations. Also, usually my phone has blown up with people sending me things. Yeah. So a lot of people, which is cool, people reach out to me and be like, hey, did you see this? Right. Before I even and it's usually also a lot of people who are international who've been awake before I am. And so they've already seen what's being published in the US press. And so they'll be like, hey, check out this link, check this out, et cetera. Or other journalists who themselves are unable, because of the unfortunate conditions in their newsrooms, to really speak out against their own newsrooms, will reach out and be like, hey, FYI, here's what's going on. Hey, FYI, et cetera. So it's usually a mix of things. And then, of course, like everyone else, I log on to Twitter and I'll see kind of a maybe a particular headline has already like a little bit of conversation brewing around it, right? Mm-hmm. And then what I try to do is when I have the capacity for it, is take that and also compare it to other headlines across, not just the New York Times, even though, you know, I was telling my producer, I'm like, oh, we should just name our show like We Hate the New York Times. Yeah. Point. But instead it's like, you know, what I try to do is go across all the different major news organizations in the United States, which is what I tend to focus on, even though there's no lack of similar headlines like in the UK and whatnot. Sure. Or even Canada. Canada is far worse, believe it or not, than the United. If you think the US is bad, you want to talk about it. Like, Canada has been shocking.
As the resident Canadian in the house, I can confirm this, that there's a kind of default Canadian dissociativeness. There's a kind of, like, the default trauma response of being a Canadian is to be somewhat disembodied anyway, and it comes through in the language, and you can see it in the, you can hear it in the voices of commentators and news anchors, and the Canadian coverage is absolutely terrible. Plus, the Canadian Jewish community on the whole is even more dug in and inflexible than the American one, it seems to me, you know?
Wow. I mean,
I have a question for you, Sana. Go ahead, Matt.
No, I was just going to say, as an American, you know, from like the country, the real America, not from Canada, we look at Canada as kind of just like, you know, it's like kind of our liberal neighbor to the north. They're like, you know, essentially communists. You guys are, you know, giving everyone free healthcare because you love Stalin.
This is some Michael Moore circa 2004 shit.
Yes.
Like, this is not, and it was played out it was played out already by then, you know?
Yeah. I mean, but listen, we stuck to that narrative. As far as we know, Canada is the America that we all wished we had. You know, that's, if you talk to any, like, capital D Democrat liberal, they'll be like, why can't we be more like Canada?
Well,
yeah, it's a giant bilingual bodega that sells insulin for 50 cents a pop. Go ahead, Sam.
I was going to say, what is interesting, though, is that when it comes to Canada, I mean, a lot of the quote-unquote alt-right movements in the United States, a lot of the kind of big figureheads, the names are Canadian, right? You look at someone like the founder of Proud Boys, Gavin McInnes, Canadian, one of the founders of Vice, from Canada as well. Jordan Peterson, Canadian.
That's right.
The relationship between Rebel News in Canada and a lot of, like, here also, you know, white supremacist groups, and like that relationship between the extreme right, even just the regular right, but like the extreme right, the extremely explicitly white supremacist groups in the United States and Canada, that's all coming. That's a Canadian export. That's what we're doing. David Frum, another example. Canada is, it has, you know, again, it's, we have a really good PR strategy, but
you guys have good Hasbara.
We have good Hasbara, absolutely.
What, Sana, did I call myself the resident Canadian, not realizing that you're Canadian?
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. That was fake news. Where are you from?
So I have a weird story, but I grew up in Vancouver somewhat. And then I grew up between the US and Canada, but Vancouver, yeah.
Well, so did I. Hi, Vancouver.
I know.
And nice. Somehow I didn't know this about you. I apologize.
When I say Vancouver, so let me get more. Don't want to get more specific on the internet. I'll say Surdell, if that makes sense to you.
I used to deliver organic groceries for Small Potatoes Urban Delivery out to Surdell.
See, that's what I'm saying. Shit like that. We don't do that in America. We don't deliver, you know, organic groceries to Surdell. No, we deliver guns to cartels. That just almost rhymed. It's interesting because I also do see some of your coverage regarding some of that Canadian Hasbara, that Canadian spin. And one of the most recent things was Canada was among a handful of major countries, major economic powerhouses to cut funding from UNRWA after the spurious allegations that UNRWA is all Hamas, you know, that was slowly but surely picked away by actual reporters. The Canada, in I think an attempt to I'm not sure. You tell me. But Canada was one of the countries that recently resumed funding, and I saw a lot of praise going its way for doing so. What are your thoughts on the reasonings behind this, and whether or not it is worthy of praise or not?
I don't think there's anything worthy of praise in stopping funding of what is the longest running and almost only lifeline for millions of Palestinians over completely unsubstantiated allegations before any semblance of an investigation could take place. So I give zero props to any country that's resuming aid to UNRWA after having stopped it. Because the thing is, the damage is done too. Mm-hmm. Right. We already have a horrific, starvation that's been spreading across, especially North Gaza. And we've been seeing children dying. There's several, so many more children who are at risk of dying from starvation in the coming days and weeks. But I think what happened here is that Canada, like a few of the other, like Sweden also, as soon as Sweden joined NATO, they're like, oh, and we're resuming aid back to UNRWA too. Right. But I think they saw, that's what they said. They saw the UN report, right? Mm-hmm. Which was probably like, no, guys, this is, because and of course, now we've also heard the fact, surprise, surprise, the Israelis tortured a bunch of people and got confessions that way, right? Mm-hmm. So I think what Canada saw, as a few other countries, is what their liability was, right? Yeah. Especially as we know that this entire genocide is being, discussed and being looked at the international court level. If I'm a Canadian, federal minister, and I see a report that very clearly says, that those allegations were completely unfounded, ABCD, and it's coming from the United Nations, I would immediately think about what my legal liability is and all of that. And I think that's what we saw there. I don't think it was some sort of change of moral heart. I do think that, the pressure on the Canadian government, maybe to an extent, but I think ultimately it came down to a very cynical move, which is what is our role in all this. And also it does align with how this story fell out of the news once it was completely taken apart. Right.
Yeah.
Once we saw that dossier, which when other news reporters were able to get a hand on it, they're like, there's nothing in this dossier that actually says what is being claimed here. Right. Now it's not a story. No one's talking about UNRWA in that way at all. And like I said, the damage has been done.
Right. And the damage.
Well, this is the trend.
Yes. Yeah. The damage is that, or at least the entire purpose of it is to exist as a news cycle for just long enough to get a rapid response from allied countries, and then to, when it's later proven to be false, forget about it. We'll move on to something else.
And honestly, it's similar with... No, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, and honestly, to me, out of all the stories that have been manufactured since October 7th, the UNRWA one is one of the most blatant in terms of, we remember when that story dropped, right? It was literally about an hour after the ICJ kind of preliminary ruling that came out. And all of a sudden, right, State Department's like, FYI, we're going to be defunding UNRWA because they're a bunch of terrorists. So, by the way, no press conference today.
Yeah.
It was so transparent how it was done, why it was done. And so to me, this story was the perfect example of a completely fabricated story that was placed specifically to remove any and all attention from what should have been even though I know a lot of people, myself included, were not necessarily very happy with the ICJ preliminary ruling, but that should have been the story, and within hours switched.
Yeah.
Do you feel like, Canada has all kinds of pressure from various sides. So if they responded to a sense of, we could be on the hook here from within, that's one thing. But do you think at the same time, there was some back channeling to the United States to daddy to be like, sorry, but, we think we're going to back out on this one. And of course the US would have been like, sure, do what the fuck you want. You did your job. You pulling out now is not going to kill the narrative. No one cares about you anyway. Fuck off. Do you think that they would have reversed course like that without checking in with The Godfather?
First of all, loved hearing a Canadian story. That is the one thing that gives me away every single time here, living in the United States. But yeah, absolutely. There was no way that the Canadian government would have made this decision without checking in with the Americans, being like, hey, guys, so what are you guys finding? Let us know, because we think we're going to actually start refund. And also, not only did they start the refunding, but they're like, we're going to give additional money. Right. Which is because they, like I said, they thought about their own necks in that moment. Definitely let the United States know. Also probably let Israel know, too.
Yeah.
Like, that's the thing. It's not just the United States. They probably let Israel know, too. So, and wasn't there also like a U.S. intelligence, which I thought was really interesting how it was reported on. So the U.S. intelligence said they had low confidence about UNRWA involvement, about any UNRWA involvement, UNRWA employee involvement in October 7th. But the way I remember it being reported, and it was really quick, but people were like, the way, like, news organizations were like, oh, U.S. intelligence has confidence that UNRWA employees were involved. I was like, no, the report says low confidence. But hey, yeah, it's become
low confidence. Low confidence is still confidence.
That's right. Yes. Like, I am very, very low. I have very low confidence in my, stamina in bed. I'm sorry. I don't know why I'm going back to dick jokes. I can't help it, guys. I can't.
You have very low dignity.
But that just means
you have dignity. That's right.
That's all that means.
Did you say dignity?
Yeah, well, no. You should have said dignity.
No, I would never say that on Ramadan. Never.
That's right.
Well, I did. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
So to continue with just some of the headlines, one of the things that I saw on your timeline especially was the New York Times and other outlets' reaction to the flower massacre that happened. What was it, like a few days ago? It's like at this point, what is time anymore? Was it last week? Feel like these massacres, they keep replacing one another. But it's interesting because I feel like one of the perspectives that we don't hear from, like, you see a lot of people who post headlines that feel either misleading or feel weirdly detached from the humanity of the thing they're talking about, but you're someone who works in a newsroom. And so for you, as someone who's a journalist and in the world of news, what are your specific issues that you have with the way that the media has been covering the war, and specifically the flower massacre? Do you remember offhand, like, some of the issues you were having with it?
Yeah, and this is, again, as you mentioned, this is something that's repeated, not unique to the flower massacre, but it is a lot of these organizations, but it's especially like the New York Times, right? And I don't want to keep beating on the New York Times. Actually, no, I do. But the New York Times, I think, excels in doing this, which is the verbal gymnastics to completely obscure and obfuscate any and all culpability of both the Americans and the Israelis, right? Actually, they'd probably blame the Americans before they'd blame the Israelis, to be completely honest. The way that the Times functions. And for me, what blew my mind was, I should pull it up. I'm sure you have it in front of you, but what was the original New York Times headline, which was something about, what was it? Do you have it in front
of you? Have in front of me, I'm not. As hungry Gazans crowd a convoy, comma, a crush of bodies, comma, Israeli gunshots and a deadly toll. This is the quintessential. Is that the original one or the final one?
I'm not sure.
Either way, it's the quintessential New York Times headline sentence structure, which is like, as something something happens, or in such and such a context, comma, and then just some kind of like poetically, like, understated thing, like, and just a kind of like, it has this hidden attitude of, we're just looking at the world and kind of shaking our heads at it.
Yeah. One of the things that I have from you was on March 2nd, one of the New York Times headlines was just "Lives Ended in Gaza." And, you know, since the war started, more than 30,000 people have been killed during Israel's bombardment and invasion. And here are some of their stories. And you pointed out that, like, there was that even in their attempt to present Palestinians as humans, the role and responsibility of Israel in 150 days of constant slaughter and starvation is muted and obfuscated. And it's like, for me, you know, I look at this and I see it as nothing less than an attempt to use the cover of, well, we're just doing unbiased journalism, to try to mute the, you know, the devastating language that would be applied to literally any other conflict.
Plus
that, they're using sensitivity language, like people online use things like unalived instead of killed.
Yes.
Which is the kind of language that drives me crazy, but I understand, like, if people are doing it for their own emotional protection.
They're trying to get around, like, content moderation. This is,
that's also true. This
these
is
guys the, are
this
the
is
moderators.
The paper of record. This is the yes. paper of record. Yeah.
When I saw that, lives ended in Gaza, like, I want to rip my hair out, right? Because here's a piece, and I know from, like, the Times would probably say, look, we also humanize Palestinians. But it's like, when the framing is like, so, like, what does that mean? Lives ended in Gaza. Like, what does that actually, because what we know what it means in terms of, like, these are people who were killed by Israeli airstrikes, right? We know what that means because we are able to look at the context of the coverage and all that. But lives ended, I mean, that's such a, also, that term also has, like, a very metaphorical meaning to it, right? Where it's like, oh, my life has ended in Gaza. I am now moving to Egypt because, my, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean that it is like your life is actually like over. Like you're,
yeah.
You're killed.
Yeah.
Right?
Gazans murdered.
Gazans murdered. Or, you know, I think the greatest criminality, and I don't use that word at all, like, lightly, but I think the greatest journalistic criminality we have seen again and again and again and again since October 7th, but not obviously, it's not unique to since October 7th, it's the last five and a half months, but the greatest journalistic criminality has been the complete removal of, again, any Israeli culpability in anything, right? And that, all, for instance, when we look at the starvation of Palestinians right now in Gaza, it's presented as though Palestinians are just starving, that there is just this naturally occurring famine there, as opposed to, this is a policy. This is not only also an Israeli policy, but it's an American policy. You that Joe Biden can't actually exert any pressure on Israel, an economy that is only surviving because of how much money the United States and some European countries have pumped into it, in addition to all the military aid that's going in. You pull back a couple billion and watch how Netanyahu and his cabinet start going, oh, I don't know about this, right? Yeah. Like, I refuse to, I also feel like that whole thing that this is like a bit of a tangent, but I feel like that whole narrative that the White House likes to push, like, every couple weeks, or like, oh, Biden just can't get to Netanyahu. Like, Netanyahu is such a bully, and Biden's really trying. Like, even that hot mic moment after the state of the, it's also, it plays into, and this is the part that gets me, it plays into anti-Semitic tropes, right?
It's like, of course.
Like, this one Jew sitting in Israel is freaking out and controlling all of the United States government. And I'm like, what are we doing
here? Yes, 100%. And this is something that I've, you know, pointed out a bunch of times because it pisses me off so much, because it adds fuel to the, it's almost, it feels like a concerted effort on the part of the Biden campaign. If not just, you know, if it's not a concerted effort, it certainly is going to be the, you know, unintended side effect, is to further radicalize people into anti-Semitic tropes. It's going to make, because I, you know, when I point this out, I have people who are telling me, no, Biden actually can't do anything because, you know, who's really in charge? Israel. As if Israel is not a client state. As if Israel's is not propped up as if they are not so fully supported by the United States in almost every single way that a state can be supported by superpower, that people will invert the power dynamic to say that, no, what's actually happening here is Israel controls everything. And
right, or the alternative is AIPAC.
Right.
Which is even more sinister.
There's
truth to it, but yes. It's like, come on, bro. Like, take responsibility. Look, do the elders of Zion have me by the balls in my life? Absolutely. Does the worldwide Jewish cabal keep me from doing the things I want, being nice to people?
100%.
Do they, you know, absolutely? Do they, you know, am I completely on their? But I'm not going to go around blaming them for it. I'm going to own my cowardice. I'm going to own my weakness. You know what I'm saying? Like, I can't blame the Jewish conspiracy for everything. The New York Times plays into this as well in the sickest way, the thing Sana was just talking about. And now I'm going to – this is a quote from my brother here, or a tweet that he tweeted out, quoting a piece by Peter Baker and Michael Crowley in the New York Times. Mm-hmm. Because according to the Times, it's Peter Baker and Michael Crowley. Biden is, quote, delivering death and life at the same time, unquote, in Gaza, quote, illustrating his elusive effort to find balance in an unbalanced Middle East war, end quote. They find that the U.S., quote, finds itself on both sides of the war, in a way, arming the Israelis while trying to care for those hurt as a result.
Ugh.
It's astonishing.
It's so disgusting because it is a narrative that is, I think, very appealing, not just to like your standard issue Nazi, but it's appealing to the libs who love more than anything to find a reason to defend Biden. Any reason at all. Biden has no power. Whenever it comes to something that he's, you know, I mean, literally, Biden has no power whenever there's something he can't get done. It's because he doesn't have the power to do it, which includes, like, recently there was a tweet from Biden in which he said something like, no one should ever go to prison for smoking just a little bit of reefers or whatever he said. And it's like, you have the power to declassify cannabis in the scheduling. You could change the scheduling of it. He himself, unilaterally, as president, could do this. This is not a question of going to Congress to see whether or not it's to make it legal or to decriminalize. It is well within his power to, number one, not enforce any of the federal drug laws against weed, and number two, to change the classification of the drug. He has the ability to do this, and it's the same thing in Israel. He has the ability to unilaterally not give the weapons that he did give unilaterally. He has the ability as president to do so much more than he's doing, but people pretend, including him, that he doesn't, and that feeds into anti-Semitism.
Well, this is why I get... Go ahead, Sana.
I was going to say, it's also mind-boggling to me. Actually, it's a mind-boggling, not really, but the fact that we do have other reporting that tells us that Biden himself does not give a shit about Palestinians, right?
Yeah.
Heard Kamala Harris herself was quoted as saying he's not listening to us. We've heard from other anonymous staffers. There was a lot of great reporting in the Huffington Post with their reporter Akram Shahid, where he's been talking, does a lot of like anonymous like sources within the State Department and White House, and they've said the fact that he won't even acknowledge the fact that Palestinians are suffering in private, he won't. Not only that, but we remember when this genocide marked 100 days and he put out that statement, right? There was not a single mention of Palestinians at all, right? So the president himself, people around him have also said that this man does not care about Palestinian life. Like, and so it's when I said earlier that it's kind of mind-boggling to me, it's just, again, going back to what I was saying earlier, is that you have to, as a journalist, you have to go really out of your way to not talk about what is being shoved in your face.
Yes.
And that is why, you know, I'm like, we need to understand that the U.S. news media is not like, I know it's like, yes, free and fair press, et cetera, right? Or free press, but it's not. Because there's something almost more unfree about a press that willingly does state propaganda without any kind of duress. And it's, you know, and which is what the American press absolutely, and especially the New York Times, has been doing.
Well, we're gonna change the subject to something more glamorous, you guys. We're gonna
Can I tell you one quick Biden thing I learned the other day?
Oh, yes.
There's an extraordinary piece in the London Review of Books by an author from India named Pankaj Mishra called The Shoah After Gaza. It's very long. It's very complex. It's an incredible history of the uses of the Holocaust in relationship to Zionism. And it's stunning in terms of its breadth. But there's one incredible anecdote in which he talks about... he says, a strenuously willed affiliation with the Shoah, which is the Hebrew word for the Nazi Holocaust, has also marked and diminished much American journalism about Israel. More consequentially, the secular political religion of the Shoah and the over-identification with Israel since the 1970s has fatally distorted the foreign policy of Israel's main sponsor, the U.S. In 1982, shortly before Ronald Reagan bluntly ordered Begin to cease his, quote, Holocaust, small h, in Lebanon, I didn't know Reagan used that term. Good for him. A young U.S. senator who revered Elie Wiesel as his great teacher met the Israeli prime minister. In Begin, Menachem Begin, the right-winger's own stunned account of the meeting, the senator, wait for it, commended the Israeli war effort and boasted that he would have gone further, even if it meant killing women and children. Begin himself was taken aback by the words of the future U.S. president, Joe Biden. No, sir, he insisted. According to our values, it is forbidden to hurt women and children, even in war. This is a yardstick of human civilization, not to hurt civilians. In other words, Menachem Begin, if this anecdote is correct, had to human rights explain to Joseph Robinette Biden in 1982. And that's who is now pretending to give half a shit, a fraction of a fuck, about Palestinian human rights, even as he's financing their liquidation and starvation.
And if you know anything about Israel's 1982 invasion of Lebanon, the first thing that should stand out to you is, of all of the Israeli aggressions / wars, to be in favor of a more aggressive action, that is the most insane one. To be like, you guys should have done more death, because that one is almost universally looked back on. Even in Israel, they're like, yeah, we were a little crazy on that one. At least they used to. Now I'm sure they're like, we should have done more.
They had hundreds of thousands of people out in the square in Tel Aviv protesting it. And
that's right,
too. Back when there was a peace movement in that country.
If you also look at, and again, this is a part that's so frustrating. I mean, there's a piece to be done here. So maybe, you know what? I just got inspired. Maybe I'll do this piece.
Yes.
But it's actually looking at like Biden's history, even policy wise, right? Like if we look at U.S. funding, military aid to Israel over the decades, right? Because a lot of people point to, well, after the 67 war is when American attitudes really changed towards Israel. And they were like, okay, we can use also Israel for... as a greater ally in the Cold War. So, yes, but the massive funding doesn't start until we start hitting the Obama years.
That's right.
And what was, a lot of people forget that not only was Joe Biden the vice president for President Obama, but also the reason why he was picked was because Obama didn't have foreign policy experience. He was foreign policy guy. He was a pretty, you know, didn't have that much experience, and all his experience was domestic. And Biden, for a very long time, has been kind of the face of like U.S. foreign policy establishment.
Yes.
Right. And so it is not a coincidence that even though the Obama presidency is always kind of depicted as he was really standing up to Netanyahu, he wasn't. Netanyahu said himself that the Obama administration was great for Israel, as even Antony Blinken, who was Deputy Secretary of State himself, had also said at, I think it was an AJC conference. But it's no coincidence that funding goes up when Joe Biden is vice president, and that the fact that we have this genocide taking place when Joe Biden is president.
100%.
And for any reporter to ignore this is, like I said, journalistically criminal. It is absolutely phenomenal.
100%. Completely agree. And the other thing that I agree with is that it's time for a break. That's right. I have to remember to go to commercial break now, because if I don't, the commercials happen on the podcast randomly, and then people yell at me. So stick around. We'll be right back.
Let's hear what SodaStream has to say.
Yeah, SodaStream.
so destructive.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes, so doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
And we're back, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to talk about some glitz and glamour. Today, our main topic is Trailblazer. That was the pun I came up with. This week, we had I'm sorry. Just let me be me.
No, I'm not sad about the pun. I'm sad about his speech and the way he made it so easy for them to misquote him.
Yes. We'll get to that.
The grammar of it. Yeah.
But. So we had the most magical night in Hollywood just happened. The glitz, the glamour, the magic of the silver screen. Surely nothing could ruin such a wonderful night like this, except for everyone who was trying to get to the red carpet. They were met with these protests right outside. This is right outside the, I believe, the Cinerama Dome. Which, if you've ever been to it, it's awesome and great. And, so they were protests outside. But in general, I think this was like one of those days where we all, you know, if you're someone who watches the Oscars, which I do, because it's, as someone who grew up here, it's kind of like a national holiday. It's like everybody, you know, like there's less traffic. Everyone's just at home watching all their favorite rich people get the statues. And in general, one of the reasons I was watching it was because I wanted to see if Hollywood, you know, in its history of being, you know, on the forefront of telling it like it is, you know, consequences be damned, if they were going to say anything about, you know, the ongoing, I don't know, genocide that's happening in Gaza. And, apparently not. There was not much that actually happened. I was watching. I was fairly disappointed.
I'm not going to sit here and let you erase one of the most important moments in Hollywood history with Mark Ruffalo walking that red carpet.
That's right.
And letting us know that he crossed the picket line, but that humanity won.
That's right. That is right. Listen, I appreciate the handful of celebrities like the Eilishes and the Rami, who's cool, and the Ruffalos and the Mahershalas. I appreciate something more than I appreciate nothing. And I will say some, you know, like, you know, Rami, I think, has done far more, you know, actually outspoken advocacy for Palestine than the people I listed. But at the same time, I do find it to be incredibly frustrating that the height of protest in this thing is a pin. And I want to give credit where credit is due, but the pin is so small. He's so tiny.
Look, man, no, look, no. You wear that pin, you're going to ruffle a few ruffle a few feathers. I fucked that up.
I know, but it was good. It was good.
Ruffle a few feathers. Ruffle a few feathers. Ruffle a few feathers.
Ruffle a few feathers. Ruffle a few.
It's also really
That's a good tongue twister.
Yeah.
But it's a vague pin, too. Like, I'm at that point where I'm like, we are 5.5 months into this genocide. This is not simply...
That's the pin?
That's the pin. Yeah, that's the pin.
That's the pin. It is a red circle and then a slightly lighter red hand. And then in the middle of the hand is a heart. A black heart. Doesn't really...
It's basically a black square. What people started... Like, we know that moment when that happened, right? In the summer of 2020, when the black squarification happened of the BLM, like, everyone's like, all right, that's the liberalization of that. Like, it was over, right? And it was co-opted. Yeah. Oh, everyone did their part. We did a black square. Like I said, I'm 5.5 months into this genocide. Like, I'm going to be an asshole about it. And I don't think it's being an asshole about it, but if people see it, I don't care. But I'm like, we're 5.5 months into this. This isn't like a far away genocide happening with the countries that you have nothing to do with. And you're like, oh, it's no, this country is overseeing this genocide.
Yes.
You as taxpayers, I as a taxpayer am paying for this genocide. Anything less than screaming at the top of my lungs about that this is a genocide that needs to end, like, is to me, it's just not good enough, especially if you have positions of power. Because there are people, working class people, students, who are putting their lives, their futures, their careers on the line because they get it, right? Yeah. They understand what's at stake here and what's happening. So when I see someone like Ruffalo or anyone else wearing a pin or being like, I'm like, I don't, like, what do you want? What do you want me to do? Be like, good for you. You can't even say genocide. Like, what do you want?
I know. It's so hard because it's like, you know, I want to encourage it. I want people to not feel like, you know, they like to not be so scared and feel like there's no incentive, but it also feels disgusting to have to incentivize being against a genocide. Like, what do I have to do for you? Like, I have to rub your back? No, I'm glad if you do anything at all, but also it's really not asking that much, I think, which is why while I was watching the awards, once the awards started, not much else was happening. Oppenheimer lost, what was the other one called? It was Oppenheimer, Poor Things. They won big at the Oscars, but the biggest winner of the night, the elephant in the room. That elephant took home most of the awards. Every single, I think, winner went up there and talked about anything other than the ongoing genocide in Gaza, except for one. And this was the thing that is swept across social media. Jonathan Glazer, the director of the now Academy Award-winning film, Best Foreign Film, a Holocaust film named Zone of Interest, a horrifying movie about the banality of evil. When he won his Oscar, he went on there on the stage, totally shaky. And I knew when he started shaking, I said, this is going to be it. This is going to be it. Because, you know, as someone who myself is a public speaker, with like stand-up and stuff, the only time I shook more visibly in public was when I was doing a speech in public about, you know, how Zionism is anti-Semitism and racism and all that stuff. So I knew he was going to say something because that's the look of someone who's about to say some shit that he knows is going to get a lot of his family yelling at him, friends yelling at him, and possibly hurt some opportunities.
Do you know what else he directed?
Oh,
I found out.
No. I know one other thing he directed, and it was a music video for Virtual Insanity by Jamiroquai.
That's amazing. So I went and saw The Zone of Interest. Zone of Interest is an incredible film. Of course it made me think of Gaza. It's brilliant. And as I was leaving the theater, I'm like, who is this guy? Well, first of all, I thought he was German. He's English. Mm-hmm. He's Jewish. Mm-hmm. You know, he directed Sexy Beast with Ben Kingsley.
Yes. Yes. Yeah.
No, you fucking won't. No, you fucking won't. Yes, you will. Yes, you will. Yes, you will.
So one of the greatest.
Yes, 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 yes. No.
One of the greatest films in the history of funny British accents, in my opinion.
It is. It is. There's not enough Ben Kingsley in it. But
yeah.
quite a hell of a director, you know?
Yes.
And it's, and Zone of Interest is wonderful. So let's see what he said.
Yeah, here we go.
All our choices were made to reflect and confront us in the present, not to say, look what they did then, rather look what we do now. Our film shows where dehumanization leads at its worst. It shaped all of our past and present. Right now, we stand here as men who refute their Jewishness and the Holocaust being hijacked by an occupation which has led to conflict for so many innocent people. Whether the victims of October... whether the victims of October the 7th in Israel or the ongoing attack on Gaza, all are victims of this dehumanization. How do we resist?
Now, the rest of that speech is fine and great, but this line that he says, and I'm going to read it because, you know, who knows? I'll probably have to take out that speech because of a copyright strike. This line that he says, where the fuck
did we stand here as men who refute?
Yes, yes. We stand here as men who refute their Jewishness and the Holocaust.
They refute their Jewishness and the Holocaust? What?
And the Holocaust being hijacked by an occupation which has led to conflict for so many innocent people, whether victims of October the 7th in Israel or the ongoing attack on Gaza.
My kingdom for a copy editor. Come on, man.
So here's the thing. When I saw this, my first response was, hell yes. And the reason it was hell yes is because, number one, he was the first person to go on there and directly talk, like, say the word Gaza, which I was
good.
Like, beautiful. But also, I think the point that he's making here of, we stand here as men who refute their Jewishness and the Holocaust being hijacked, by an occupation is something that I think, you know, for me is like almost like the premise of everything of me talking about this, other than obviously, you know, the moral imperative is also, you know, it's secondary to that, but it's still pretty important to me, which is that, like, this is a complete hijacking of Jewishness. It's a complete hijacking of the Holocaust and the lessons of the Holocaust, all to be used for the purpose of doing what I would consider a classic Holocausty behavior. And that is something that, for me, I was like, that's an incredibly powerful message. On the other hand, a little copy editing, a tiny bit, I think would have gone a long way, because I did go, I had to listen to it a few times because of the where he put the emphasis while he was saying it too.
Yeah.
And I was like, does he mean refute? And then when I read it in a sentence, I said, oh, yes, we refute that our Jewishness and the Holocaust is being.
If he had said that our, it would have changed the entire sentence. He used the gerund being. He says, we refute our Jewishness and the Holocaust. That's a clause unto itself. Being blah, blah, blah.
Yes.
It's a, there's, I'm not a grammar teacher, but a grammar teacher could absolutely pinpoint and say why that's an unclear English sentence.
Sure.
And it, and it's, in fact, it's the perfect unclarity to give to your enemies. I totally give him props for saying what he said. I'm glad he said it.
100%.
It's just, and they would have fucking distorted it and been in bad faith about it no matter what he said, even if it said it perfectly. I was just personally like, so close.
Yeah.
Did you guys watch The Gentleman Behind Them? And you see how he's like smiling, and then as soon as he hears refute Jewishness, he's like, oh.
Yeah.
Like, the way his face completely, like, he's trying to control it, but he's like, what's that now?
Yeah.
No, I thought this was, like, I, you know, I have my own issue in terms of, like, the kind of equivocation in terms of, or the way that Palestinians are made into secondary victims.
Right.
As well, always after, you know, Israeli victims of October 7th, but, like, so I understand why that was done, but I kind of wish, that being said, I do think it's very powerful. And I think that the strongest part of the statement is the context in which it comes, which is what the film is about.
Yes.
Right? If this was just some other film, like if this was
Shrek 3, The Shrekening.
Yeah, absolutely. Shrek 3.
Barbie.
Or if it was Barbie or Poor Things, and they just like, oh, I mean, I guess that would be powerful maybe, but it's like, okay. But for someone who actually made this film about the banality of evil to then speak to people who are absolutely participating in that as well, right? Who are in the zone of interest, right? Like, that's the thing. They are, we all are, if you think about, right? We're in the zone of interest. Which is why I wish the word genocide or something more had been used, just because I think when we refuse to acknowledge what this country, this government here is doing, we keep ourselves purposely in that zone of interest as well.
Yes.
I understand why you didn't, and I get it. But like, I thought with the context, it was incredible. Someone on Twitter pointed out that at least as of this morning, the Academy Awards had not put out his speech. They'd put out almost every other single speech, but not his.
Yeah, the claim around that was something around like ABC gets first dibs for the clips, and so therefore the Oscars YouTube channel can't post it until, you know, 30 days or whatnot. But it all rings a bit hollow, just because you see kind of like, I don't know. I mean, listen, that could be a perfectly Cromulent explanation, but at the same time, I'm just like...
The Cromulence for me is a little in question.
Yes, sure.
Isn't it notable, though, that in the past few weeks, the biggest dust-ups, the thing that's inflamed the Hasbara industrial complex the most, have been two award speeches at film festival or award ceremonies, yes. Victory speeches by Jewish...
Yes.
Filmmakers, one of whom is an Israeli.
That's right. I mean, it says everything. And I know, Sana, you do have to go. But do you have any final thoughts on that?
I think the one thing that made me really sad, actually, was when I saw that speech, was thinking about how we've yet, and I know Rami's been mentioned, but we've really yet to see powerful Muslim and Arab,
yes,
individuals in the entertainment industry say it with their chest.
Yeah.
Right. And to me, this kind of, it's a whole other conversation about representational politics and all that,
right,
because I'm not quite sure the point of accumulating any kind of power or proximity to power, if it ends up being just more about self growth versus utilizing that power to actually, you know, hold power to account as well. So to me, like, yeah, that just made me sad, where yes, the most powerful speeches or call outs that we're seeing right now are coming from people who are Jewish, from filmmakers who are Jewish, or people who have, again, who are in positions of power who are Jewish. And it just kind of breaks my heart a little, because I also know that a lot of people are just afraid of like repercussions for their careers and whatnot. But it's, you know, in these moments, I'm like, there are things more important than a career as well.
You know, it's a perfect illustration of that, the limitations of representation politics, Sana. Here you and I are, two Canadians. We outnumber this guy on this podcast. And you know what? It's probably an American team who's going to win the Stanley Cup this year again.
That's right.
Maybe, but the Canucks have a chance. We're doing all right, but...
But yeah, but it's still going to be filled with Canadians and some Russians and Swedes.
I'll tell you this.
That's true.
Whatever happens, I promise not to watch it, because I don't get it. Sana, where can people find your work? And what's the name of your series on AJ Plus?
So you can find my work on Twitter, Sana Saeed, S-A-E-E-D. Also on Instagram, Sana Face, very easy to remember. I actually have two series on AJ Plus, one which was literally created as a response to everything that's been going on. Mm-hmm. So it's called The Occupation Style Guide. It's primarily on Instagram, and Twitter is where primarily our audience is. And then my main show is called Backspace, which is a media critique series that looks at major news headlines in the United States and the kind of genesis of the way that these stories are told and how we can tell those stories a bit better as journalists.
Hell yeah. Well, check them out. It's very good. And follow Sana on Twitter, because you're one of my favorite follows, and you're the homie. Also,
I'm gonna quickly say, I just want to say that Matt, you have been truly a breath of fresh air, and I'm not kidding when I say a lot of my group chats are pretty much at this point just fan clubs of you.
Oh, so,
yeah,
that's
everyone's
nice.
Always like, Matt Leaves the best. Oh my god, yeah, like literally every other day we're like sharing your tweets. We're like, oh, Matt's so kick ass.
Oh, that makes me feel
amazing
good.
Work, and thank you so much, and especially for like using comedy in the way that you've been using it has been really needed too. So I really appreciate that. Thank you.
I appreciate that. Tell the homies at AJ Plus that me and Francesca have a baby now, and you know, like, hey, what about Newsbroke coming back? Help us.
would support that. I would support that. Honestly, I would support that in this moment. So
that would be so sick. But that really, honestly, that makes me feel great to hear. And I love all y'all. And tell the group chat what's up from me.
I will. Oh my God, they're gonna freak out.
Hell yeah.
Awesome. All right. Thanks so much, guys.
All right. Bye.
Bye, Sana.
Sana said, everyone. To round out.
What's up with me not being in their group chats?
I was just thinking the same thing. I was just like,
Why did they create a group chat to erase me and hate me?
Honestly, I think it's a Canadian thing. I think sometimes people, when they find out someone's like Canadian and stuff, they're just like, oh, let's not. We're looking for an American.
Believe me, people call me a self-hating Jew. That's got nothing to do with it. It's the Canadian side that sparks the.
You're a self-hating Canadian.
That's right.
To finish up what happened with this John Glazer speech thing.
John Glaze?
Yeah. Mr. Glaze, glaze it up. 420, glaze it. As soon as it happened, I feel like the Hasbarosphere went fucking insane. Like people were reacting. First, it was just a full-on meltdown. We had people just being mad online, which is my favorite, is when they're just mad online. We had this guy, Avi Kaner, or Connor, said, "You hijacked the Oscars for your naive, selfish, vile narrative, blaming the victim. Gaza was not occupied on October 7th.
Yes, it was.
Yes, it was. Butchered your brothers and sisters. Shame on you. Yeah, yes, it was. This idea that that Gaza is not occupied because in 2005 they removed settlers is just complete horseshit.
And moved the operation of the prison to the perimeter of the prison.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. They just control literally land, air, and sea, and they control everything. They can't.
By the way. Did you see the clips of the U.S. trucks coming through with concrete slabs to build this pier? Like just a huge convoy of like, just like truck after truck after truck after truck. I'm like, wow, man. Look at that. Hamas is so, they're so evil. They'll let concrete through, but not food. It must be, you know, Israel must be letting them do whatever they want, and it's really just the palate, you know.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, if the concrete can get in there, certainly the food can. Clearly Hamas is letting in the concrete so that they can chisel it into little rocks to throw.
That's right.
That's what it's for. But yeah, also, by the way, they estimate that pier that they're building for aid will take at least 2 months, which... means 2 months of starvation, and that
well, especially if you have to, and then you have to go through peer review.
God damn you! Damn you, Mate!
Am I right?
Damn you!
Am I right?
Am I right? As you cry, I get no respect.
No. It's just the horribleness of my own pun makes me weep.
No, I know. But I love the idea of the stand-up comedian who's just doing jokes about genocide. And every time he says, am I right, folks, tears are pouring from his eyes. This guy knows what I'm talking about. Where are you from? There was just like tweet after tweet. My favorite was John Podhoretz, the lesser Podhoretz, just tweeted, "Jonathan Glazer, you can go fuck yourself and stub your Oscar up your ass."
Like, in that order?
I mean, I assume he would, if he had chance to edit it, he'd say, "You can go fuck yourself with the Oscar."
Right.
Something along those lines. But
that reminds me of a fantastic Jordan Peterson tweet that I just have to find. Hold on a second.
Is it the Elmo one?
It's the Elmo one, yeah. It's the Elmo. Hold
on. We got to find it because this is, I saw this.
Damn it. Tig put it out. Where was it? It's on Twitter somewhere. Can someone find it?
I'm going to find it because it is. So recently, the account... Elmo's official Twitter account tweeting out
Ramadan Mubarak, everyone.
Yes, tweeted out a Ramadan Mubarak to everyone, which is, you know, very nice and it's beautiful. for, you know, all of the Muslim viewers of Sesame Street to get a nice Ramadan Mubarak from Elmo.
Ramadan.
And of course, Jordan Peterson said, and
can I do my best, Jordan? I've got a pretty good Jordan impression. Can I do it?
Oh, okay. All right. Well, I'm gonna share this so that so you can see it. And Jordan Peterson quote tweeted it with this right here.
And he did it in one of his like free verse poems, you know, with like the line breaks. Yeah. So it's the same.
Hamas will never win over the righteous keepers of the West. Up yours, scum.
And I thought to myself, up yours?
Up Elmo's? Up Elmo's is the only way Elmo ever gets to speak.
That's right.
The only time Elmo speaks is when someone's got it up Elmo's. Yay!
Just the puppet thing. I couldn't.
Honestly, fantastic. And we're going to have to bring
gum.
We're going to have to bring back your impression. We're going to have to find more Jordan Peterson content specifically for you to read.
Well, you're going to have to find it and give me some time to lean into the tears of
the tears.
Choked rage that come whenever I think about the good I'm doing in the world.
Oh.
For the young men of the West.
I love it because it sounds like you're singing Rainbow Connection, but about how much you hate trans people. That's this whole thing.
Why are there so many tweets about pronouns?
And whether you're girls or guys. So, yeah, there was a bunch of tweets, but after a while of people just yelling and, you know, just wanting to do violence against a Jewish man who just won an Academy Award for a Holocaust movie in which he mentioned the fact that the Holocaust is being hijacked.
Such a notoriously anti-Semitic, Jew-unfriendly town as Hollywood.
Yes.
I would think this would be an inspiring story of overcoming the odds.
That's right. But instead, people freaked out, and they eventually took a breath, and they said, okay, wait, guys. Let's put our heads together, and, you know, we got to center ourselves, we got to focus. You know, people need us right now. They need us to lie to them about what had happened.
Yep.
And so they did, and what they found out was this angle, perfectly put by former liberal Zionist turned full-on Hezbollah and genocide apologist, Batya Unger Sargon.
Oh.
She wrote, "I simply cannot fathom the moral rot in someone's soul that leads them to win an award for a movie about the Holocaust, and with the platform given to them to accept the award by saying we stand here as men who refute their Jewishness."
You know where the lie is in that sentence?
She can't fathom,
No, it's the period. It's the period she put after Jewishness.
Oh, yes.
If she'd been honest, it would have been an ellipsis. Because that's just not where the sentence ends. It's not even where the clause ends. We stand here as many refute their Jewishness and the Holocaust being used. And we already criticized the construction of that. But she's smart enough to know that that's not what they said.
They all know and they all say it. I mean, Batya, the other lie there was that the kind of like implicit thing where she's imagining a soul. Like, I think she's just jealous because she sold hers a while ago.
Fair enough.
You know, she's just mad at anyone who still contains one.
I mean, to her credit, I saw her on System Update debating Glenn Greenwald, and she's completely wrong on Gaza. But at the very least, she's not one of these conservatives who's like calling for censorship on campuses. She's telling Jewish students to stop being whiny. And you know, she's calling out people like Ben Shapiro and these fucking hypocrites who make fun of safe spaces for black and trans people, but now want safe spaces for Jewish. She's like, no, have the courage of your convictions. If you're going to be an anti-snowflake, don't be one yourself. I respected that. But this sure. is just this is just well, such Batya bush league is one of those bullshit.
People, Batya is one of those people who like came from. I was first made aware of her when she was, I think, editing the foreword.
Yeah,
and I remember. I mean, she also may have written some stuff for Tablet and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And I remember there was glimmers of this. Like, there's two possibilities, yeah. and we should do a whole episode on Batya because I think she's a perfect example of when liberal Zionism turns into what it inevitably turns into.
Look, she could have gone the Unger route, or she could have gone the Sargon route.
I mean, yeah. Yeah.
We're seeing the Eye of Sargon now.
Yes. But instead, she went full apologist and genocidal. And so, yeah, she's got these glimmers of, like, you know, I guess her past self, where she would just be like.
Principal. Yeah.
The principal, right. But the thing about it is that, in general, her entire thing is, like, lying. And she's. Yeah. She's someone who lies for the purposes of the Israeli war machine and state. So
she wears the Magen David around her neck like an amulet of like,
yes,
of like, that's what she's loyal to. She's loyal to that identity mm-hmm. and that country.
Yes.
And fuck any other sense of principle.
Yeah. She kind of just hates Jews is the thing with her. Just the way in which she talks about Jewish anti-Zionists, it comes from a place of being like just sick and tired of Jews always being so complainy, which is.
Well, we got into this with Shmuley too, right?
That's right.
It's like,
yes,
it's the classic Zionist self-hatred of like, we need to stop being such victims. We need to turn our whining towards military might.
Right.
They must fear our whining.
Yes.
Too long have the goyim mocked our kvetching. They need to fear our kvetching. Yes. They need to fear our self-pity and our self-obsession. They will tremble in their unkosher boots when they hear us whining about how we're the victims of everything.
Yes. Yeah. No, I mean, it is really like, it's, you could draw a straight line in terms of that parallel, which is funny because she did like back in 2012 an expose on Shmuley that was very good, and kind of like pointed out his self-obsession and his kind of shaky past and you know, his misdealings and fraud with you know, stealing from the I think it was like the L'Chaim Center or whatever, something he created in England and whatever, and then he had them pay his mortgage, like real scumbag stuff.
To life embezzle,
yeah. embezzle my wife. So, everyone was, this is the thing that they latched onto, was a complete misreading of this speech to talk about him refuting Jewishness. And, and my favorite was, I was just like scrolling through all the people who were talking about this. And I found this one video where I was like, who the fuck is this guy? And it was turned out to be the executive director of Stand With Us. And I just I loved it because I love that the executive director of a very well-funded Hasbara organization, this is like the video he made. I was like, don't you guys have like a team? Let me just play it for you.
Jonathan Glazer, you stood at the Oscars and you said that you refute your Jewishness. Well,
no,
it doesn't work that way. Now, I'm not ordained as a rabbi, but my understanding has always been that you can't refute your Jewishness. You could decide to be a Catholic priest tomorrow, but you'd still be a Jew. And just as I'm not a rabbi, I also don't speak on behalf of the Jewish people. But I believe the majority of Jews would say to you, Jonathan, we refute you. We refute your actions, which will encourage more record-high, violent anti-Semitism. We refute your words, which will empower the Nazis of today, Hamas.
Just a close-up on Hamas, in case you didn't know who the Nazis of today were. Not the actual Nazis, well, like the ones who marched in Charlottesville. It's just like, this fucking guy, how do you spend 3 full minutes on a premise that you just made up out of whole cloth? You know what I mean?
Are you ready for some refute ball?
Nice. Oh, not really.
Not really.
Well, no, that was good. We stumbled on, at the very least, an episode title.
Refute Ball.
Yes. Are you ready for Refute
Ball? Monday night. It's Monday night Refute Ball. Recording this.
That's right. Yeah. But yeah, it was, you know, at the end of the day, I think my thoughts on this are the speech was great, except for, you know, it was easily, I think, misinterpreted. And but yeah,
I think Sana's right that it was too polite. I think it was sure. It's great that it happened. I'm totally going to be generous and say yes to something happening and good for him. And he strikes me as not a very powerful speaker and sure. Nervous, clearly, you know, but mm-hmm. I think just the lesson in it for all of us is half measures and half steps mm-hmm. in a moment like this are very, very dangerous because yeah. if you don't come out with your full throat and just say it, all of your effort to be measured, all of your effort
to thread nuanced, that needle. Yeah.
To thread that needle just lets them grab the needle and poke your eye out.
They're going to do that anyways. They're going to do that anyway.
No, you're not going to escape the consequences by being nice.
Yes, you're never going to use the right words. The right words will always elude you because there are no right words other than I stand with Israel and there was, you know, a ceasefire on October 6th. Like there's no correct words that include human rights or empathy for the Palestinians.
That's right. So you got to do what Malcolm X said and make it plain.
Yeah.
You know, like just plain as if I was advising him. But it's tough. It's tough because he's got his own. I bet Mark Ruffalo, when he got home last night to his wife and kids, they sat down at the breakfast table maybe this morning, was like, I want to tell you about something really courageous I did, you know.
See this
pin? I was walking the red. See this pin?
This pin costs more than your car.
See this watch? Put that orange juice down. Orange juice is for Oscar winners only. No, but, you know, he's like, you know, I was walking the red carpet and someone turned to me and I put a fist up and I said, humanity won. And I had my agent for the rest of that awards ceremony blowing up my phone,
yeah.
telling me, you know, you're never going to work in this town again. Mm-hmm. In March.
Yeah.
You know, right. but I did it anyway.
I did it anyways. Yeah. I mean, like, that's the thing is the amount of half measures that you see, you know, like, again, I'm someone who's desperately hopeful that there will be sort of a come to Moses moment within the entertainment industry and community. And I mean, and the only reason this is purely selfish reasons, because I'm just like, listen, I would love it if, I could continue doing the things that I have spent my career doing without like worrying about every job that I'm not getting it because I'm an anti-Zionist. But at the same time, you know, I still am incredibly critical of the fact that, like, you know, there's all these pussy half measures and it's like, you know, you're going around wearing a pin and you certainly like that should be the lowest end. In fact, that should be something that I think should be in a fair world that would have been mocked a long time ago.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's the black square. It's
the when Clickhole had that. Are you taking the pledge? You remember that?
Yeah. There was no, I don't. What was that?
It was in the aughts or the early 2010s, mm-hmm. in the times of these, you know, sort of viral Facebook campaigns for nothing in specific, and it was like take the pledge, and you mm-hmm. watch this video of like, you know, young, fresh-faced young influencers be like, I'm taking the pledge. Are you taking the pledge?
Yeah.
This February something, hundreds of thousands of people will take, and of course, it's never specified what the pledge is, but you're just taking the pledge is the thing.
Yeah.
No, I think the takeaway from all this is we got to quote Mike Ehrmantraut here and say, no more half measures, Walter.
That's right.
No more half measures.
Yeah, yeah. And I will say this before we move on to just one more thing.
Oh, great.
I think that looking at this, the reason that I am optimistic and I end this with a good taste in my mouth is because of the fact that, like, if ever there was a sign that the PR battle is all but lost for Israel, it's the fact that there was nothing. Nothing at the Oscars that was purely just about October 7th and about, you know, pro-Israel. Like, think right. about the Oscars after 9/11, right?
Sure.
Like, think about the Oscars after Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Think yeah. about the amount of stuff that people had to say, the amount of grandstanding.
100%. You know what's wild to realize?
Yeah.
There was more explicit October 7th propaganda at a recent U2 concert in Las Vegas
yeah.
than yes. there was at the Academy Awards.
Yes. And
they sang a song. Have we played that on this podcast? Have
you no, that? But I've
That's
not,
wild.
I didn't know about that. I would love to play that.
I'll send it to you.
Yeah, it's like, I look at that and I say, like, this is, you know, not only was he not booed for that speech, but he was cheered for it. There were
yes,
people
he was.
Who were scared to cheer, absolutely.
That's right.
But he did get a round of applause. And I think that, like, I look at that as, like, a pure PR battle loss. Like, the fact that liberal Hollywood, like, did not, like, they just pretended it didn't happen. And that's the big reason the Hasbaras are mad. It's because the only statement that mentions October 7th is the same statement that says you are using our Jewishness and the Holocaust to justify your aggression and, you know, occupation and all that stuff. And I'm like, to me, I'm like, that is wild how much goodwill was squandered by Israel.
It's wild that they even let him won, because they could have known he was going to do that. I think
oh, yeah.
he's made public statements. The funniest refutation mm-hmm. of his speech, I forget if it was Anlon Levy or which
or
one of
Noah
these punks.
Noah Tishby, maybe.
No, it was a guy mm-hmm. who said something like, the zone of interest, no, it was Ben Shapiro,
of
maybe.
Course.
Something like, the zone of interest is a film in which there are no Jews. Those are the only kinds of Jews that matter to Jonathan Glazer, the invisible right. ones, the ones Jewish suffering. So, he takes the, like, very bold and I think extremely effective artistic choice that's
yes.
at the central conceit of that film,
yeah.
which is that you're on the outskirts of Auschwitz
yes.
at the home of its commander and
yes.
his you know, gardening happy wife and their miserable empty lives that's only filled with their power and privilege. And it's actually a very human look at dehumanization of the oppressor. And meanwhile, the oppressed are just a rumor. They're just...
right.
They're just
that's
a
like
wisp
the point
of smoke.
Of the fucking movie.
That's the fucking point of it. And he takes this as like, this guy wanted to erase the Jews. It's as if there were no Jews killed in the Holocaust. This is like anti-art. Like you just.
I love yeah. that. I saw someone else tweet. This is some nobody, but it was like someone tweeted like, this isn't a movie about Jews. This is a movie about Nazis. Yeah,
yeah.
Like essentially saying, you know, people keep calling this a movie about, you know, a Jewish director who made a movie about Jews. And blah. No, it's a movie about Nazis, as if it's somehow about how Nazis are good.
Well, but that's the real. I think that's they're deeply uncomfortable with, actually.
Yes.
To watch that movie, to have to face
yes.
what Nazis actually are. They're
yes.
not. They're not a slick villain played by Ralph yes. Fiennes in Schindler's List, which was a great performance.
Oh, yeah, yeah, sure.
Well-written character, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They are boring.
Yes.
Bureaucrats. They are moving pieces around on a chessboard. They are doing their job. They are going home to their wives. They are serving powers much bigger than them. They're worrying about promotions.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
They are banal as banal can be. And
yeah.
it's very uncomfortable to see that because it disrupts the narrative of angels and demons that we
yes.
need to hold on to if we're going to use the Holocaust to justify what Israel's doing.
100%.
And it forces us to look in the mirror at, we're all kind of like that.
Yes.
In a way.
Yes.
You
no,
know,
I think that's exactly right. It's like we've moved, watching a movie in which Nazis aren't portrayed as almost like this like superhuman evil, like once in a century or once in a generation or once in a millennia devil people sprouted from the ground who came up just to do murder with their pitchforks and their forked tails and stuff. It's like no showing them as people who you could see, you know, it's like you can see people in your own life, including yourself, being like lulled into this bureaucratic form of complete,
industrialized assembly line mass murder now. But when you say we say once in a century, once in a lifetime, now I'm doing an alternate version of the Talking Heads song, once in a lifetime. You may find yourself living in a beautiful house with a beautiful wife on the outskirts of a concentration camp. And may you may say to yourself, well, which crematoria should I install?
This is not my zone of interest. Oh, man. All right. That has been, I think that's an episode of Bad Hasbara. What do you think?
That has been Hasbara.
That has been Bara. thanks, Bara. Everyone, for listening. Daniel, thank you so much again for being my co-host. I love you, dog.
I love you, cat.
Oh, hell yeah. Fuck yeah. Do you want to plug anything?
Nah, I'm everything's good and plugged, but you know, find me in the usual spots.
Fuck yeah.
If you want more nonsense.
Yeah, if you want more nonsense, find him in the spots. You know where he be. All right. Badhasbara@gmail.com for all your questions, comments, and concerns. And what else? We got patreon.com/badhasbara. Subscribe. And until next time, from the river to the sea, wearing a red pin is not enough for me. Sorry.
Sorry.
Sorry, the Canadian story.
Jumping jacks was us. Push-ups was us. Krav Maga us. All karate us. Taking Molly us. Michael Jackson us. Yamaha keyboards us. Jar Jar Binks on us. Andor was us. Heath Ledger Joker us. Endless Red Six us. Happy Meals was us. McDonald's was us. Being happy us. Bikram Yoga us. Invented all that shit.